Tot 11 uur de boeddhistische omroep met De Middenweg. Presentatie Tom Maas.
Goedenavond. Zen-boeddhist Chris Ives is hoogleraar religieuze studies aan Stonehill College in de Verenigde Staten. Zijn meest recente boek heet Imperial Way Zen en het gaat over het Japanse zen-boeddhisme in de eerste helft van de 20e eeuw. Tot aan het einde van de Tweede Wereldoorlog werd het Japanse imperialisme namelijk gesteund door vooraanstaande zen-priesters. Ives gaf in juni aan de Vrije Universiteit in Amsterdam een lezing over zijn boek. Marloes Dazal sprak na afloop met hem over het één worden met je wapen, het volledig opgeven van het zelf en over het gebrek aan compassie bij verlichte zenmeesters. Een integrale vertaling van dit gesprek vindt u op onze website boeddhistischeomroep.nl.
As many of you know, in the popular imagination, Buddhism is a non-violent detached religion. When we think of Buddhist ethics, some of the things that often come to mind are some of the things I just put up here on the board, the five precepts.
I'm Chris Ives. I'm a professor of religious studies at Stonehill College, south of Boston in the United States, and author of the recent volume Imperial Way Zen. This expression refers to the form that Zen took in the first half of the 20th century while that religious tradition was supporting Japanese imperialism, supporting the Japanese military leading into and during World War II.
Now the subtitle of your book is Ichikawa, Hakugen's Critic and Lingering Questions for Buddhist Ethics. Who was this Ichikawa?
Ichikawa Hakugen was a Rinzai Zen priest and professor at Hanazono University, which is a Rinzai Zen university in Kyoto in Japan. And he was interested in Marxist thought even before World War II, though during the war, like a lot of Japanese, he kept a very low profile. And then after the war, while a lot of Japanese Buddhists were talking about peace and democracy, and Japan as a whole was sort of struggling with the issue of the war and war responsibility, and in some respects not wanting to look that hard at that issue, Ichikawa felt a sort of moral calling to raise the question of war responsibility and to write about what Zen Buddhists and other Buddhists did during World War II and to discuss what that means in terms of Zen and ethics and Buddhism in general. And in that respect, is a fairly unique Japanese Buddhist figure because a lot of Buddhists did not really explore the historical record of Buddhist nationalism, but he felt compelled, in part because of influence from his Christian and Marxist friends, he felt compelled to raise this issue for fear that Japanese Buddhism might repeat that mistake in the future.
You point out that Zen Buddhism in Japan has a long history in nationalism and even worshipping the Japanese emperor like a sort of divine figure. Mm-hmm. How did that come about?
Basically, since Buddhism was introduced to Japan in the 6th century and Zen was introduced in the 12th century, Buddhism has always had a very close relationship with the government, where Buddhists will do certain rituals for the health of the emperor or the military dictator, the shogun, or aristocrats who are the patrons of Buddhism. And in return, Buddhism would always receive protection, certain types of financial support, often in the form of rice, which was like the currency or the money at that time. They would be given land, building materials, even labor. And so from the beginning, Buddhism and the government had a very symbiotic relationship. There was a kind of mutual dependence. And so that historical pattern has always been, in many ways, accepted. So there's no concern about the separation of church and state or religion and politics. They've always been seen, with a few exceptions, as supporting each other in Japanese history. And that pattern continues into the 20th century and is one of the reasons for this phenomenon called Imperial Way Zen. What Zen Buddhists were doing during World War II was a new form of a traditional pattern of working with the leaders and supporting the government.
Now, in your book, you also write in 1937, there were two Soto Zen writers, and they stated, in order to establish eternal peace in East Asia, we have no choice but to exercise the benevolent forcefulness of killing one so that many may live.
Yeah, that expression you do hear in some of the Zen rhetoric in the 1930s, and the derivation of that, in general, what that reflects is an idea that you'll see in Mahayana Buddhism, that there are circumstances where it is morally acceptable to kill a person who is about to kill many people. And so there you get that expression, kill one so many can live, a kind of preventative violence, almost a kind of just war theory that it's okay to kill someone if they're about to kill others.
Now, apart from the imperial and totalitarian regime, even within Zen Buddhism itself, there are grounds to find to justify the violence and the killing of people. In the principle of no self, for example.
Especially in Zen history, the idea of no self, it's metaphorical, it's more of a spiritual construct that has to do with letting go of self-attachment, letting go of the ego, and waking up as a broader sense of self, a different kind of self. And during the war, what you would see is certain conservative Zen figures using that language in what sounds like a more literal way, saying that Japanese have a lot of debt to the emperor because of all the blessings they receive from the emperor or from the state of Japan. They need to repay that debt. The best way to repay their debt to the emperor is to serve in his army, and maybe ultimately what you will do is give up yourself. You will die as a self as a way of repaying that debt. And there's even talk, you know, a way of becoming one with the emperor or the Japanese state. And so there they take the Zen expression, dying the one great death, which is metaphorical for dying as an ego and waking up as a different kind of self. And they give it an actual literal interpretation in terms of dying a physical death on the battlefield. And it does seem they, you know, took that seriously. They really were talking about going off and dying in battle, if done with the proper attitude, was a kind of religious or spiritual action. So in some respects, yeah, they were not speaking metaphorically. They really were talking about physical, bloody death on the battlefield.
Now, Ichikawa wrote, in true peace of mind, when fighting commences, one enters war samadhi. What did he actually mean by that?
What Ichikawa is saying is that the Zen approach to liberating people from suffering is focused on cultivating a kind of peace of mind. And by that, he's referring to how Zen talks a lot about not reacting, not judging, again, not being caught up in a sense of me versus you or good versus evil. And what he is basically referring to is the Zen traditional emphasis on overcoming the subject-object duality, overcoming the sense of being a separate self and becoming one with things, breaking down that sense of me here and the world out there for a kind of unity experience. And what Ichikawa is criticizing there is how certain Zen masters use that idea of becoming one with things, not to talk about becoming one with the beautiful cherry tree, or becoming one with the taste of one's tea, or becoming one with the child you are hugging, but becoming one with the act of fighting war. And what Ichikawa is arguing is that a lot of Zen leaders were working with people who were going to war and giving them a way to look at being a soldier, look at fighting, that could be somehow spiritually meaningful, maybe even spiritually satisfying. And so you see that rhetoric when Zen masters are working with Japanese military officers or ordinary soldiers saying, if you're going to go to war, don't get caught up in worrying, don't get caught up in decisions about good and evil, don't resist, just become one with what you're doing, obey your orders, fight. And that is a kind of war samadhi. And samadhi is a Sanskrit term that has a lot of different meanings, but in this context is a way of referring to that lack of any sense of separation from the content of experience, that kind of unified, concentrated experience. And so there is rhetoric about, yeah, war samadhi, becoming one with the act of shooting your gun or marching or whatever. And in that sense, in Zen terms, finding a kind of existential freedom in the middle of combat. There's one Zen master that he quotes who's talking about, you know, when you're ordered to walk, you know, march, march, tramp, tramp, the sound of your feet hitting the ground, or when you're ordered to shoot, bang, bang, this idea of just following orders, not resisting, not judging, just becoming one with what's happening in the moment. And, you know, as the popular expression goes, sort of going with the flow.
Now, another aspect is letting go of any preferences. So if you really are able to let go of all your preferences, there actually is no good or evil anymore. Killing someone might be as good as doing something good.
Yeah, that's a classic issue in a lot of Zen rhetoric, in a sense, Zen ethics. What does it mean to transcend good and evil? What does it mean to let go of making distinctions between something that's good, something that's bad? And the extent to which that kind of rhetoric or that kind of experience does result in a kind of moral relativism where you're now unable to make any judgment between going off and killing or staying home and resisting militarism.
People making vows to refrain from such actions as harming or killing, stealing, engaging in sexual misconduct, basically engaging in any kind of incorrect speech, lying, and then engaging in the use of intoxicants. And often people think of this as, you know, a religion that's very much centered, especially on the first precept, the rule against any kind of harming or killing.
Now, in your talk this morning, you also stated that it was like the original five precepts seemed to be sort of forgotten mm-hmm. in this period of imperial Wei Zen.
Mm-hmm. For a lot of us who have experienced Buddhism in Europe, North America, other places outside of Asia, we often look at Buddhism as very much focused on the precepts. For a lot of people who are trying to live a Buddhist life, there's an attempt to understand the precepts, reinterpret them, think about whether the precept against killing means I should be a vegetarian, should I be against the death penalty, should I be against all wars or only some wars. But in traditional Zen in Japan, there wasn't much study of the precepts. The attempt in Zen is to get people to get in touch with their basic Buddha nature, whether that's through Zen meditation or Zen meditation plus koans. And the idea is that once you get in touch with that and you fully awaken, you are like a Buddha, and naturally you will be compassionate, you'll be wise, you are now beyond the selfish ego. And the idea is often, at that point, ethics will happen naturally. But of course, that's the rhetoric. When you look at the things that I look in this book, this phenomenon of imperial Wei Zen, these supposedly enlightened Zen masters did not seem to necessarily have that much more wisdom or compassion in terms of what they did with Japanese imperialism, Japanese militarism. And so the question is, does that awakening to your Buddha nature really make you more ethical? Or, as some Zen teachers will say, no, it really isn't about ethics, that's something separate. So there's a lot of debate even within Zen about the extent to which Zen meditation or awakening, whatever that is, makes you ethical, or whether Zen is really about something different, dealing with more existential questions and certain types of suffering, in a sense more psychological than ethical. Thank you.
And that brings us to the whole question of compassion. Often we think of, yeah, that's one of the key moral values in Buddhism, that with compassion, that is what will help you, in a sense, do the right thing. That's maybe the basis for a deeper, truer Buddhist ethics, rather than just looking at the precepts or certain guidelines. The tricky thing is, when you look through Japanese history, you'll see various ways that Zen masters in their sermons, in their texts, talk about compassion. During the war, as I just said, compassion is used to say, okay, this is a compassionate act the military is doing. Ichikawa saw himself as living out a kind of compassion by using Marxist categories to criticize Japanese wartime activity.
Ik ben Bert van Baar, cultureel antropoloog. En heb een paar boeken geschreven over boeddhisme ook. Boeddhisme in de notendop, Dalai Lama wijzen van deze tijd. En ik ben ook betrokken bij het opzetten van een nieuw curriculum, boeddhistische studies hier aan de VU.
Vanmorgen was je ook aanwezig bij de lezing van Christopher Ives. Jij had daar een opmerking over de nadruk op compassie binnen het Tibetaans boeddhisme. Want dat lijkt binnen de Zen, als je dit boek leest, een beetje te ontbreken.
In zijn boek komt hij eigenlijk uit op... In Zen zou men meer moeten kijken naar een nieuwe ethiek. En vraagt hij zich af van hoe het compassie... Kan dat daarbij helpen? Nou, met name in de Tibetaanse traditie is het compassieonderricht heel erg ontwikkeld. Dus ik vroeg me af van nou... Misschien een dialoog tussen die verschillende boeddhistische tradities zou heel vruchtbaar kunnen zijn.
Maar zeg jij nou eigenlijk dat Japanse zen-boeddhisten nog wat kunnen leren van Tibetaans-boeddhisten?
Oh, dat is heel gevaarlijk. ik denk dat we allemaal van elkaar kunnen leren, zeker. En wat me persoonlijk aanspreekt aan de Tibetaanse traditie... is dat er een heel scala aan vaardige middelen is ontwikkeld om compassie op te wekken en om dat te ontwikkelen. En het is heel gedetailleerd, wordt het in kaart gebracht, geanalyseerd en ook om manieren om dat zelf in jezelf wakker te roepen. Ja, dat is meer ontwikkeld daar dan in de Zen-traditie. Dus als je het zo scherp wil zeggen van kunnen we nog wat van de Tibetaanse traditie leren, dan zou ik dat kunnen zeggen, ja.
Were there actually any excuses or apologies made by the Zen masters who were in charge in the Second World War?
There have been a variety of responses after the war. One thing that's very difficult and we have to be very careful about is a kind of intellectual imperialism, a kind of anachronism where we, say in 2010, we know about some of the things the Japanese troops did in China, in the Dutch East Indies, in some cases to Dutch people there or to people in the Philippines and Korea. And so a lot of us, if we are existing at this point in history, will see what Japanese did as very violent atrocities, torture, the problem with sex slaves, the problem with gruesome medical experiments, attacking cities like Nanking, etc. And one question is, did these Zen masters really know exactly what was happening in the war? There was a lot of censorship. Some Zen masters will say, I didn't know that the Japanese troops were doing brutal things and horrible things to the Koreans or the Chinese. I thought they were being celebrated by the Chinese for liberating them from Western imperial powers. So there's the whole question of what did they know during the war? So after the war, you will get some Zen masters, in a sense, making an excuse saying, well, we didn't have information. We didn't really know what was going on. For all we knew, the Japanese troops were being welcomed with open arms across Asia. Some Zen figures say, maybe I made a mistake, but now it's okay. I do support peace. I do support democracy. And doing a kind of quick shift of position. Ichikawa criticized some of his fellow Buddhists for that, what he called quick and easy pacifism after the war. And one of the problems is the whole question of war responsibility in Japan is very complicated in the post-war period in terms of, was the emperor responsible, or was it only the top leaders in the military, or was it other people? And so in many ways, a lot of Japanese Zen leaders after the war simply didn't talk about it. And then it was not until the 1990s that Zen starts coming out more publicly, talking about their war responsibility, expressing regret for helping the militarists, and starting to look at that historical record. It took them a long time to really publicly talk about what they did during the war.
And there was even a Dutch lady who was involved in this process. She started writing letters to several Zen teachers.
Yes, there was a book that was written by another scholar, Brian Victoria, in the late 1990s entitled Zen at War. And like Ichikawa in Japan, Brian's book outside Japan opened a lot of people's eyes to what was going on with Buddhism during the war. And there is a Dutch woman, Ina Boutendijk, who is a practitioner of one new form of Zen called Sambo Kyodan, and she read Brian's book and started thinking about why it was that Zen supported the Japanese military, because her husband was a boy in the Dutch East Indies when the Japanese invaded and took over the Dutch East Indies, and her husband Jaap and his family were interned by the Japanese military, and they suffered greatly for over 2 years in an internment camp. And so what Ina decided to do after reading Brian Victoria's book, she decided to write over 20 letters to prominent Zen masters in Japan, asking them to help her understand how it was that Zen supported the Japanese military, the military that hurt her husband and his family, and of course many other Dutch people at that time. And her letters, much more than Brian's book a few years earlier, was a catalyst that got these prominent Zen Buddhists in the Rinzai type of Zen to begin talking about their war responsibility. And so many of these Zen masters wrote Ina letters directly back to her, expressing remorse, expressing their regret. Her letters made the leadership of that Zen institution issue a public proclamation of their reflection, their regret about what that type of Rinzai Zen did during the war.
Obviously, this raises the empirical question of, okay, during World War II, if these very prominent Zen masters were really enlightened, had this insight, realized their original mind, were equipped with wisdom and compassion, why weren't they more, you know, aware of what was going on? You'd expect a compassionate, courageous bodhisattva to be resisting Japanese militarism, saying, no, what we're doing as a country is increasing suffering. It's not helping liberate suffering beings, but rather it's adding to their suffering, whether it's Koreans, Chinese, Dutch, Vietnamese, whatever, Malaysians.
Nico Tiedeman, we hebben net de lezing van Christopher Ives bijgewoond.
Het is natuurlijk een vreselijke geschiedenis. Ik put een beetje troost dat alle religieuze tradities worstelen met hun maatschappelijke posities. En alle gaan wel eens over de scheef als het gaat om de handhaving en de verbreiding van hun eigen leer. Dat troost een beetje. Maar je draagt het verleden mee. En het blijft belangrijk om dat onder ogen te zien, daarover na te denken. En natuurlijk, wij zeggen nou makkelijk, dat doen we anders. Maar de werkelijkheid is altijd weer ingewikkelder dan het lijkt. Dus het is voor mij een goede last om steeds weer na te denken van, kijk uit wat je doet. Weet dat het kwaad altijd aanwezig is. We moeten het best doen het kwaad te vermijden. En misschien helpt de geschiedenisles ons een beetje.
A lot of what I'm talking about today and in the book has to do with traditional Zen Buddhism leading up to 1945. If you look at contemporary Zen Buddhism, whether it's Thich Nhat Hanh coming out of the Vietnam War, other Buddhists in Europe, North America, and even in Japan, you will find Buddhists now becoming much more concerned about justice. And so what you're seeing is an attempt by contemporary Buddhists to think about, okay, what might compassion mean in society, not just the monastery? How might we take the traditional Buddhist precepts and apply them to questions like war, pollution, sexism, racism, homophobia, a lot of these issues that we talk about as ethical issues in society? And so in many ways, Thich Nhat Hanh and other contemporary Zen Buddhists around the world are fairly unique relative to the tradition. I've been mainly talking about the Japanese Zen case, but there are other cases where if you look at the history of Buddhism in Tibet, in Southeast Asia, Korea, Japan, by and large, Buddhism has been in those countries, with a few exceptions, very much doing what we see in Japan, cooperating with the government, getting support from the merchant class, getting support from the king, doing rituals for the king, the very close connection between the Buddhist community, the Sangha, and the rulers. And what you see is someone like Thich Nhat Hanh coming out of the Vietnam War in a very unique circumstance, beginning to think more broadly, kind of a transnational Buddhism or a global Buddhism. This is a very interesting moment in terms of the history of Buddhism, to see people really trying to think beyond national identity, really truly do what Buddhism in principle and ideally has always been about, which is thinking about all suffering beings. You could argue that what Thich Nhat Hanh is doing is coming up with a new form of Buddhism, or what you might argue, and some people do argue this, what he's also doing is returning to the original Dharma, to the message that the Buddha had, his message of peace and nonviolence.
Because you're a practicing Zen Buddhist yourself, at the time you were working on this book, did it reflect in a way on your own practice?
Yeah, while working on this book as a Zen practitioner myself, it made me think a lot, especially about the core question of the degree to which Zen meditation really does transform a person ethically. And it made me think a little bit about how I could augment or add to my Zen practice certain things from other forms of Buddhism, especially from certain types of Theravada Buddhism or insight meditation, Vipassana styles of Buddhism, which will spend more time looking at certain mental states like greed, anger. So in some cases, my own meditation has shifted. Also in terms of thinking about Zen and ethics, both as a practitioner struggling with the question of how to live in this very complex and crazy world, and as a scholar of Buddhist ethics, sort of thinking through some of these issues, I found that in some ways I've shifted away from what some of my Zen teachers had taught me over the years. In particular, I've become increasingly skeptical of the traditional Zen claim that an awakening to emptiness or an awakening to your original nature, to your Buddha mind, in and of itself gives you a certain kind of ethical insight or makes you a wise and compassionate bodhisattva. I think to really be a fully ethical person in society, especially as a lay person, working, voting, shopping, doing various things, there's more that needs to be brought into one's Buddhist path than simply meditation and certain moments of samadhi or focus, mindfulness, you know, awakening. I don't think that Zazen alone, Zen meditation alone, is enough to be a fully ethical person or a fully ethical Buddhist. I think there's more that's needed.
U hoorde Chris Ives over zijn boek Imperial Way Zen. Dat is verschenen bij University of Hawaii Press. Voor meer informatie en een integrale vertaling van het interview kunt u terecht op onze website. En tot zover deze uitzending van de Boeddhistische Omroep. Die werd samengesteld door Marloes Lazal. Presentatie en eindredactie Ton Maas, techniek Rob Gerritsen en Boris Nieuwenhuizen. Als u een van onze uitzendingen heeft gemist of meer wilt weten over onze programma's, kijk dan op boeddhistischeomroep.nl. Ons telefoonnummer is 035 677 1611. En op Facebook zijn we aanwezig onder de naam BosRTV. Aanstaande zaterdag in de Zevende Hemel beeldend kunstenares Eva van Dam over haar werk en deel 3 van de serie over de heropleving van het boeddhisme in Indonesië. Ook start dan een nieuwe serie die is gewijd aan de 6 paramita's. Als eerste dana, oftewel vrijgevigheid. En dat alles zaterdagmiddag om 3 uur in de Zevende Hemel op Radio 5. Graag tot dan.